From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. However wild and crazy the news out of Washington has been, Wall Street's keeping calm and carrying on, carrying upward. Yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average cracked the 22,000 mark for the first time ever. The president's claiming credit. The bulls and the bears are arguing over whether the market will keep growing or take a tumble. What's the message for the rest of us? This hour on Point, the Dow at record highs and the economy behind it. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's the high Dow say to you, mean to you? Do you see an economy that merits record high stock prices? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The Dow Jones hit a milestone yesterday, breaking above 22,000 for the first time moments after the New York Stock Exchange opening bell rang. CNBC marked the occasion on their morning show, Squawk on the Street.
And we'll see if Dow 22K is a reality after, here we are, Dow 22,000 for the first time ever after hitting 21,000 back on March 1st.
Let's look at what's going on. We're joined from Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, by Steve Leisman, senior economics reporter for CNBC. Steve, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Wonderful to be here, Tom.
We know Apple has had a huge few days here, and people say that helped drive it over yesterday. But what's going on? It's been, what is it? It's just been up and up in recent months. What's happening?
Well, you know, we debate the recent past and trying to figure out what is behind this. It seems very clear you can date a surge in the stock market since the election. And it's fair to say that it has continued since the inauguration. I'm clocking here about 21% since the election, and it seems like things turned on a dime there. So what we're debating is the extent to which President Trump and his agenda or election is responsible for it. And then, as you suggested, companies like Apple, there's also been a surge in earnings. The economy has continued to chug along. We're doing that typical 2% growth with a little bit better in the second quarter. Jobs continue to be relatively strong. So that seems to be a part of it. As best I can tell, it looks like there was a shift. Initially, it looked like it was a Trump trade where there was optimism about his agenda. And then to the extent that that looks to have waned, or the possibilities of that agenda have waned, it looks like the robust earnings have taken over as the reason for the foundation for the stock market.
This is a very long bull market now. Is it the longest ever? When did this start, this upward ascent?
Well, it's funny. We have a thing that we name the Haynes bottom, for what it's worth, after the late great anchor for CNBC, Mark Haynes, who on the day, I've got to get you the day when the market was low, it was 6,600 in the wake of the financial crisis. And Mark said, this is it, we're all done. And so we have jokingly called that the Haynes bottom. And I've got to find that number for you. There it is, just about on my screen. Call it March 9th. 2009. And if you remember those very, very trying days as the market sold off in the wake of the financial crisis, and we have been not quite straight up since then. But look, if you were in then, and hopefully you didn't sell ahead of it and you bought more afterwards, you are a little bit closer to retirement now than perhaps you were before.
So all through the Obama years, up and up and up, and since Inauguration Day, up some more. President Trump, very happy to take credit for that. Here he was talking with Fox News ahead of his joint address to Congress. This was back in February before where we are now. Here's President Trump saying, hey, look what's going on. It's me.
Take a look at what's going on with the stock market. Trillions of dollars of value have been created since I won the election. I mean, trillions.
And here is Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin talking with the House Appropriations Committee in June. Hey, it's Trump.
If you look at the stock market, there's been trillions of dollars in increase. That's a sign of confidence in the Trump administration's economic policies.
We're going to talk with Robert Shiller and Jeremy Siegel about what they see going on. But how does do investors here look, on the one hand, Steve, at all the turmoil that gets talked about out of Washington, which doesn't typically inspire investor confidence? On the other hand, up it goes.
So I have a theory on this I can't prove, but I think it's got some foundation. I would suggest that the failure of Hillary Clinton to be elected had as much to do with the rise in the stock market as the election of Donald Trump has.
And what do you
by
mean?
That I mean, so Hillary Clinton's election was well priced into the market. Most people thought it was going to happen. That's the way the market was priced going into the election. Along with Hillary Clinton's election would have come a 5% increase in taxes, which she had proposed, along with perhaps other taxes and regulations, and a continuation of the regulatory environment of President Obama. Donald Trump has issued a lot of executive orders and had some limited effect on regulation. But clearly, what we know from Donald Trump is taxes on business are not going to go up, and they may well go down. We also know that he is not in favor of greater regulation, and if he could, he would decrease regulation. I think all of those are positives for business, and frankly, it would be wonderful to see the Democrats look at these numbers and, by the way, look at business and consumer confidence numbers and try to understand why that shift has created the surge that it has.
But when I look through the headlines today on the sort of morning after the Dow breaks 22,000, it looks to me like as many doubters as believers in a future, on an onward, upward march, Steve.
I think that's right. And I think that what all the polling that we do here at CNBC shows the market has pushed back and also reduced the probabilities of some of the Trump agenda actually becoming law. But I think the point is that there is not going to be worse than they had before. And the previous trajectory has been essentially curtailed or otherwise vectored away.
Steve Liesman, Chief Senior Economics Reporter for CNBC, please stand by. I want to bring in two huge voices in economics right now. Jeremy Siegel joins us from Philadelphia, Professor of Finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, Academic Director of the U.S. Securities Industry Institute. He famously predicted Dow 20,000 when that sounded a little outlandish. Now he's been talking about the Dow hitting 30,000 in the next few years or so. Jeremy Siegel, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from New Haven, Connecticut, Robert Shiller joins us, Nobel Prize winner, professor of economics at Yale University, famous for predicting the dot-com bust in 2000 and the U.S. housing crash that sparked the big recession in 2007. Robert Shiller, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Jeremy, are you really talking about 30,000? And is it straight line, or do we have to go down in a big ditch first?
But no, 30,000 is going to come in the early 2020s. That's I think, 6 or 7 years away.
Okay.
And that's just a sort of a normal rate of return, which I predict is going to be about 5% after inflation from where we stand today. So that gives you about 2023 as an estimate.
Okay.
It's not tomorrow. Not tomorrow, and likely during Trump's administration.
What do you think of the long market we're in right now and the spike we've seen in recent months? Do you attribute that to something fundamental in the economy or political tea leaf reading? What?
Well, I think Steve, that we've heard, has basically got the story right. I think the Trump agenda of less regulation and the hope of corporate tax reform still is a positive feature for the market. But I think over the last few months, it has been superseded by a very, very good earnings in the first and now the second quarter. It's the first time that we've actually had almost as many firms raising their what's called forward guidance, mm-hmm. which is their estimates over next year, as we've had lowering. It's the best that I've seen in 2 or 3 years. And by the way, the low dollar is definitely helping because almost half the profits of the S&P 500 is generated in sales abroad. And when they, you know, we get earnings in dollars, and if the euro is going up as it is and other currencies going up, that translates into more dollars. So the weak dollar plus a recovery in Europe and really good earnings, I think, is really probably prominent now. However, I still think the hope of a corporate tax cut, not so much personal, although they'd like that, is still part of the bullish mix here.
Robert Shiller, in spite of all that, you're bearish about what's out there right now. You've got your cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio that you look at, and also the sort of narrative that's driving the market right now. Why bearish, Robert?
First of all, I like what I heard from Steve and Jeremy. They're all parts of what's going on. But I think also the market is heavily psychological, that it's not so rational. It's not like mm-hmm. people are calculating what the corporate profits tax cut will be. If that's what they were doing, there should have been a bigger jump on the day of the election.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more I think Trump is important. It's a matter of style, though, or story. He's kind of making it interesting to be in the market. People don't want to be left out. It's things like that that are driving the market. By the way, the market set record highs under Obama.
Sure.
So, but I think it's interesting to talk about Trump because he is such an unusual step in U.S. history. And it's kind of freeing people to be a little greedy or a little selfish. You know, that's American now. It's the American dream, okay? Things like that are just changing the psychology for now. But I don't have a strong confidence this will continue.
What about the fear factor? There's been a lot of tumultuous, you know, talk and heat and flash out of Washington. It's got some people unnerved. But it's
Tom.
Yes.
So I would just weigh in a little bit. First of all, the work that Robert has done on the psychology of the stock market is epic and should be read by everybody. So let me just say that going in. I do think there is some calculation about corporate profits and the possibility of a tax cut in the following sense. If I'm going to get these earnings and anything I get in terms of a corporate tax cut on top of that is essentially gravy. So what that does psychologically, I think, is create a floor for being at high levels. So I feel a little bit more comfortable buying at these levels because of the idea that I could get a corporate tax cut on top of it. But I will say the fear factor is very important. There are ways that President Trump could massively mess up the economy. Maybe we talk about that a bit later.
We'll come back and look at it. There's a rationale for where the Dow is right now. Robert Shiller says, okay, watch the story. Watch the psychology. He's a bear. Jeremy Siegel sees Dow 30,000 sometime in the early 2020s. We're not talking about tomorrow. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the Dow at record highs and the economy behind it. Room to grow, room to tumble. New 22,000 market hit yesterday. Here's the sound of the opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange this morning. And here, CNBC correspondent Bob Pisani celebrating the Dow's record-setting mark yesterday, attributing part of the surge to Apple's unexpected big third-quarter gains.
Today, it's about Apple getting us there. Apple's up about, what, $9 as I was coming down here, and that put us over the top.
We're going to look at Apple later in this hour. Big numbers coming out there, but it's not only Apple. Here's Pisani talking about a number of companies that helped push the Dow over 22,000.
400 of those points of the 1,000 we had since Dow 21,000 has been Boeing. McDonald's helped, United Health Group, Caterpillar helped.
We've got a terrific crew to look with us today at what's going on. Robert Shiller, Nobel Prize winner, professor of economics at Yale University, famous for predicting the dot-com bust, the U.S. housing crash that sparked the recession in 2007. He's a bear about the market right now. Jeremy Siegel made a lot of noise, turned a lot of heads a few years ago when he said Dow 20,000, but here we are at Dow 22,000. He's still relatively optimistic, sees Dow 30,000 if you look into the early 2020s. Nothing special necessarily there, he says, but that's where he sees things going. Steve Leisman is with us, senior economics reporter for CNBC. You can join us as well. How do you see the U.S. economy now, its path, its underlying strength? Do you see a Trump effect, upside, downside in the economy, in the stock market? And with his messages on taxes, trade, regulation, what is the Trump impact that you see here? Tom in Burlington, Wisconsin. Tom, you're on.
The buying surge that we've had is basically panic buying. It's the counterpart of panic selling. Mr. Trump's programs are all inflationary. The smart money looks at that, and they got in that market in the beginning of the surge here. And the Janet Yellen has done everything she possibly can to slow things down here. And with this $1 trillion he wants to put in with this infrastructure program he's got going, it will be really enticing to Congress because the congressmen can't resist getting money put into their districts. So in my opinion, it's really panic buying, and now the small investor is getting sucked into this deal. And I just wonder, as your guest, which part of the surge is that the fear of inflation that is pushing this up, and how much inflation could be really is good for us?
Tom, we'll look at that right now. Jeremy Siegel, may I come to you first on that? Do you see a case for panic buying about inflation fear? I mean, there's an infrastructure proposal, but it's not anything like law.
You know, I do believe psychology that Bob describes is very important, but this bull market has often been called the most unloved bull market in history. In fact, I don't see much of the public really going for it. I mean, it's so very different than the dot-com boom mm-hmm. that we saw in 1999 when, as Bob describes in his book, people were around the water cooler talking right. about how much they made in pet.com. This is not that way. Now, there are a few stocks that are, Tesla, Amazon, mm-hmm. I mean, that do gather
off the
interest.
Charts. But yep.
Yeah, that are way up there. But we're in – I don't think this is a – at least at this stage, not saying that it couldn't happen. But at this stage, I don't see this as a panic buying market. Also, on the inflation front – I mean, that's been the pleasant surprise for the market is how little inflation we've had as we've pushed unemployment low. And I think that's been a positive because it stays the hand of the Fed from raising aggressively.
Robert Shiller, do you see an inflationary threat in the Trump approach, the one our caller appears to fear?
Well, I think he refers to panic buying. And I think that it's correct that the mood is not euphoric. What is driving the buy? I like to bring in other things that are relatively okay. not mentioned. I think that people are in a sort of, I don't know, panic would be too strong a word, fearful state about the state of technology and automation, robots replacing jobs. And they don't connect it in conversation a lot. But I think people want to have a nest egg. They want to own part of the technology sector or part of the financial sector. And this is driving – ultimately, when you decide to get into stocks, that's an emotional decision. It's not – most people don't do it. They don't really yeah. think about it. But now we have a president that thinks about it, and we're worried, well, I still have a job. If I'm doing something now, is it going to be replaced?
And so you mean people are hedging, Robert Shiller? They're hedging by buying tech in case tech kicks them out of a job and sends a robot to do their job?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, it's definitely at work in many people's thinking. It's hard to infer causality. But, newspaper articles are out there every day mm-hmm. about some new – now they're talking about crewless ships – sailing across the ocean with nobody on board, carrying cargo. You keep getting stories like that. And it's not – it can't be irrelevant to such a fundamental decision as my decision whether to take risks in the stock market.
Steve, what do you see out there for fear factors? Our caller says inflation fear, panic buying. What are the fear factors? What do you see, Steve?
Well, a couple things. First of all, I think the behavioral economic literature suggests that people are – there's more panic on the way down than there tends to be on the way up. People are more afraid of losses than they are
sure.
losing gain. So I think that's – I think it's perhaps overstated. I'd instead, Tom, like to use the caller's ideas to emphasize a point, which is mm-hmm. this idea that small investors could get sucked in here. And I think he's right about that. I think there tends to be sort of mob psychology when it comes to these things. And this is a time to be sober, to be objective. People should be in the stock market, should be investing there, but don't get sucked in by headlines of 22,000. Get a regular plan. Stick to it. When things are terrible, don't sell. When things are terrific like this, don't come in and buy with both feet. Don't jump in with both feet. I think it's a time to be sober both on the severe downside and on the upside like this. There is a danger of getting sucked in. On the issue of of dangers and fears out there. I think there's a lot of concern about President Trump's international policies, especially when it comes to trade and immigration. You began this section talking about Apple. Apple, I think, made $37 billion in profit last year. It has an international supply chain, relations with China. If they were to be messed up considerably, the ability of Apple to source its product. Apple sells internationally, as Robert suggested earlier, as do a lot of the S&P 500 companies. If those trade relations were to be disrupted, as well as, for example, the North American supply chain under the NAFTA rubric, if that were to be messed up, that could have impacts on profit. So those are the big dangers, I think, that are out there.
Jeremy, what about trade? I mean, for years and years, we were told that this was a major pillar of global economic growth, and now it appears to be facing headwinds on all fronts, and many of them produced in the United States, those headwinds.
Right. It is still a pillar and very important. I actually think the market is breathing a bit of a sigh of relief that Trump has not gone, you know, whole hog the way he sounded on the election trail. You know, instead of, you know, getting out of NAFTA, now we need to renegotiate NAFTA. What I found was surprising is the big hit the Mexican peso took after Trump's election. Do you know it's made it all up? It hasn't been as bad. Now, there is this immigration coming forward, but basically who Trump has hired on his economic teams, except for Navarro, have been much more pro-trade and realize the importance of the global economy. And, you know, whether they've had a moderating effect on Trump or he realizes, you know, that he's not going to be able to get anything really big, I think we haven't seen that clampdown. I certainly agree with Steve. If he does get a huge clampdown on tariffs, trades, quotas, restrictions, this is very, very bad for the market. But I think at this point, if you would have asked 6 months ago, investors, they would probably say, you know what, it hasn't been as bad as I had feared it might be.
Robert Shiller, what about the trade factor? I mean, NAFTA still stands and talk about rejiggering that, but TPP's gone and there's a lot of tension around trade. What do you see there?
I don't think that's the major factor. You know what worries me now? I do questionnaire surveys of both individual and institutional investors. One of my things is, do you think the market is highly valued, low value, undervalued in the market, or about right? I see we're at record lows, almost record lows in confidence among individual investors in the valuation of the market. It's the only time it was worse since my surveys began in the late 1980s was in around 2000. So we don't believe in this market. And I think that there could be a correction in the stock market that is unrelated to any of these logical factors. It just starts, and then people see it falling, and they think, maybe this is it, and the market goes down substantially.
Steve says, you know, steady as she goes, don't panic if that happens. But I'm looking at your headline already in February of this year. You were saying it's time to reduce your holdings.
Yeah, I'm not talking about panicking and selling everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm intrigued by the Trump effect too. I think it might go up. By the way, Jeremy says Dow 30,000 by sometime in the 2020s. Doesn't impress me. That would be something like less than 40% higher. But remember, the Fed has a target of 2% inflation a year. So by the mid 2020s, we're talking about prices that are like 25% higher. So he's talking about a capital gain on the order of 1% a year. So I don't mean to diminish. Yeah, we could hit 30,000.
Bob, I think I was doing the following calculation. I think we're going to get about a 7% return in stocks from current levels. That is lower. This includes inflation of 2.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 5% after inflation. That is lower by a point and a half than 2 than the long run history, because we are a bit above historical valuations. So basically, you know, with a 7% return That's basically what I projected. The Dow has a 2% yield, so the actual thing is, you know, going up, you know, a little bit lower. But that's the projection I'm basically making. So I do think, and I know you think it's much lower, Bob, but I do think that from current levels, long term, you're going to get 7% nominal.
Before inflation.
After inflation. 5% after inflation, yeah. Which is compared to, you know, if you want to buy, you know, the inflation-protected bonds, which we call TIPS bonds, the 10-year is selling at 0.5%. So I still think there's a great advantage on stocks over bonds, certainly at this. And real estate is quite high, too. I don't think it's crazy. Actually, in the United States, relative that I've looked at it, The Economist magazine and others, we're still one of the cheapest in the world relative to many other countries. But nonetheless, I think that the advantage over bonds is very substantial. And by the way, in 2000, that was absolutely not the case. Stocks were crazily higher, and of course the interest rates that you could get on bonds was also much higher, so we didn't have that advantage. So, mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking at a 5% after inflation rate of return, which I think is quite decent in today's environment.
Mark in Charlottesville, Virginia. Mark, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom and speakers. You may have just answered my question, actually. What I was concerned about is my perception is with interest rates so low, it drives investors to the market, and that has been one of the driving forces for the advance in the market. And I'm wondering what the speakers think about the relationship between interest rates, the low bond yields, and that as a prime stimulus over the last 4 years driving people into one other investment. And the other corollary is I think that it yields – one of the reasons I think there's so much insecurity about the market is because it is the sole investment available to people. People are worried before they were able to diversify into the bond market, and that's not the situation anymore. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you very much.
Yeah, terrific. Thank you, Mark. Steve, I mean, we hear all the time from people pulling their hair out about the terrible return they're getting on their savings accounts and feeling like maybe some feel, as Mark says, that they're sort of marched at bayonet point into the stock market. Because where do you get a return on your savings?
There's no doubt that low interest rates is something that has helped the market and helped the market throughout the since the financial crisis. There is a correlation that guys like Jeremy and Robert look very closely at. It's sort of the Fed model, I think they call it, where you look at the outlook for interest rates or the current interest rates mm-hmm. and figure out that, hey, I've got no other place to put my money but in the stock market. I think the good news in that regard is there isn't a whole lot of expectation that from a previous call that inflation is going to go up or that interest rates it's going to go tremendously higher. Listening to the Fed, which I do every day, I don't see them really pushing up interest rates a whole lot over the next couple of years. In fact, it looks like of late they have really dialed back their expectation for how high they're going to push interest rates. They had originally said they're going to try to bring it up to the overnight rate to 3%, but now it may be something more like 2.5, or a little bit sort of right around there. So that's also a positive outlook for stocks. Whether or not it's an artificial support, I think we can debate that because there's a lot of discussion and work that's been done showing, you know what, interest rates ought to be lower given our demographics, given the technology underneath. We can have that discussion, but there's a lot of things that, you know, it's not just the Fed keeping interest rates low, it's the market and a lot of the foundations of the market that are keeping interest rates low.
Do you hear people saying, look, I'm there because I have nowhere else to go? Mark says, can't go to bonds, they don't look good these days, can't leave in the bank, there you're earning nothing, inflation's
so, all the time, Tom. And I will say, I just recently sold some stock in my efforts to be objective in the sense that I have a stock bond portfolio split that I like to stick to. And I got a call from my financial advisor because of the recent gains in the stock market. Said, Steve, your percentages are out of whack. We should bring them back because that's what we agreed to. And I did it. But at the same time, I have absolutely regretted it in the sense that that money is now sitting there in very low interest-bearing fixed income accounts. But I feel good that I made a decision based on an objective reason anyway.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Dow at record highs and the economy behind it. Room to grow, room to tumble. Before this hour is out, we'll take a closer look at Apple. They've had some very big numbers, big performance and projections coming out lately. That had no small effect on the market itself, helping drive it over 22,000 yesterday, highest ever. Robert Shiller is with us this hour, Nobel Prize-winning professor of economics at Yale University. Jeremy Siegel is with us, professor of finance, University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Steve Leisman is with us, senior economics reporter for CNBC, and you can join us as well. How do you see the U.S. economy now, its path, its underlying strength? Is this stock market fizz all about Apple and the giants? Does the high Dow have a counterpart on Main Street where it feels real to you or not? Robert Shiller, what about for lots of people listening here? I mean, we see these, the Fed puts out numbers saying nearly half of Americans are not invested in the stock market at all. So does it matter to if you don't have even a fingernail, a 401k or something in there? Does it matter to everyone who doesn't, Robert?
Well, I think that the U.S. has a business. The business of America is business, to quote Calvin Coolidge. We have a history of involvement. And that's probably a good thing. So I think that it is a good thing for people to get involved because they learn about it. They start thinking about it. And having knowledgeable population is part of our strength. On the other hand, I'm not sure this is the best time to go into it. Maybe somewhat. I could see, if you don't own any stocks, I could see doing that now, but not plunging into it because it is a highly priced market right now.
But Jeremy Siegel, what's it mean for listeners who may have not 1 cent in there? And the headline is here about half of Americans just aren't engaged with the stock market.
Right. And by the way, back in the 50s and 60s, it was probably about 70 or 80%. So we have increased engagement a lot. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, anyone who's still working for one of those firms that has a defined benefit plan their company has invested in the stock market for their pension.
Well, good luck to them. I mean, the very few of them.
They are disappearing, and no one. You're right. That is true. But when one has to realize that, a strong stock market has been correlated with a reasonably strong economy, which means a lot for employment. Anyone working for a firm in the S&P 500, if your firm is doing well, it's less likely you're going to be fired. If the stock market is down, as it was after the financial crisis, we had unemployment at 10%. So, the stock market, even though it's over volatile, and we have to give Bob Shiller credit for really, showing us analytically why that was true many, many years ago. Every recession, the stock market has gone down. Now, it's gone down sometimes when there isn't a recession, but when the economy is better, it tends to rise. So, in a way, a good stock market generally correlates with good economic activity. So you should be happy when the stock market is doing better, even if you don't own stocks. But I'm going to underline what Bob said. If you own zero stocks, if you have a 401k or start your IRA, if you work for yourself, the government gives you an awful lot of incentives. And I think Bob and I are both pretty much indexers when we talk about where you should go, broad-based index funds. I'm not a picker of stocks. You should really start at least some stock plan at this point.
Gisi in Fort Meade, Maryland. Gisi, thanks for calling. Gisi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I certainly disagree with one of your guests about, being happy about this stock market, euphoria right now.
Okay.
Because let's not forget that the majority of Trump voters, all the coal miners in the Rust Belt, probably don't even own stock. And I'm trying to see how all this translates into actual jobs for all these people. Because in the long run, less than probably 50% of Americans are invested in stocks. So how does all this, look at Apple. Apple uses a lot of automation. How many jobs do they have in the United States? How many people does Boeing employ? So how do these gains in the stock market actually translate to actual jobs in these Rust Belt areas? That should be the question.
Steve Jobs and Rust Belt from Stock Market Gains. Are you willing to draw a line there?
How many pens and how long is the sheet of paper that I have to actually make that happen? Look, there are a couple – I think the caller raises an excellent point. I think that what he's talking about is the kind of shift from to the silicone molecule from the hydrocarbon molecule, if you will. Mm. Growth these days comes with fewer jobs. It comes with less need for resources. It comes with less square footage in real estate. It comes with a less need for capital. Think of what was that company, Snapchat, that had an initial valuation of like $16 billion. And I exaggerate here when I say they had three employees and four desks. Mm. But somehow a $16 billion yeah. market cap. That's where a lot of growth is coming from. At the same time, there are some sort of well-known macroeconomic effects of a higher stock market. Let's begin with what we call the wealth effect. That the idea, the estimate, is that every dollar of stock gain leads to an additional 5 cents of spending. Maybe it's more on the way up or the way down. There's a debate about that. So it does help consumer spending. The other thing is, think about it from a macroeconomic standpoint, stocks as a cost of capital. When my stock price is high, I can get more money for less of my company if I need to raise money. So that can help. So there is a self-reinforcing macroeconomic aspect to this. But whether or not it leads to jobs in the Rust Belt, I think that's a stretch.
Nancy in North Branford, Connecticut. Nancy, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I think that the reason that average people aren't excited about this 22,000 is that average people's lives aren't getting any better. CEOs get rich by squeezing the middle class and the poor workers who are the ones who actually do the work. Top employees get huge bonuses even when their companies lose money. Mm. And then they cut benefits and they keep pay low for workers. So regular people's lives just aren't getting any better, and there's a wider gap between the very rich and the average person. Thank you.
Nancy, I really appreciate your call. Robert Shiller, you talk about narratives. There's a narrative that's got legs.
Right. Well, Hillary lost. Hillary might have done redistribution. I think there's a danger for the stock market in the future of just the opposite of what Trump is saying. Maybe people don't really like to hear redistribution, but that's what has happened in the past. And as she is absolutely – Nancy is absolutely right. Inequality has been getting worse and worse, and it's been more concentrated in the wealthy sector. Trump managed to get elected as a billionaire himself. How did that happen? I think it's an anomaly. It's based on his abilities as a motivational speaker. He's sort of telling, I'm going to make you rich. After 4 years and it doesn't happen, people might elect somebody else. I mean, there could be the opposite of what Trump says. There could be increases in taxes on corporations. We'll just wait and see.
The interaction never ends. The narratives, the politics, the economics, and then there's the stock market at record high right now. What an interesting conversation to hear the three of you sort of walk us through what's going on and where it might go. Robert Shiller, Professor of Economics at Yale University. It is always terrific to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Shiller.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Siegel, professor at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Same. Always great to have you. Thank you very much for being here today, Professor Siegel.
Thank you, Tom.
And Steve Leisman, senior economics reporter for CNBC. You put it so clearly and well all the time on the air and right here again today, Steve. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
In a moment, the big shine on Apple. This is On Point. So, who do they say lifted the Dow over the 22,000 mark yesterday? Apple. Who's sitting on the biggest pile of cash in the stock market? Apple. Who, at 41 years old, is surging more like a new startup? Some say, yep, Apple. Joining me now from San Francisco to talk about that is Alex Webb, technology reporter for Bloomberg News. His beat is Apple. Alex, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi there. Delightful to be with you.
So what happened this week with Apple that got so much noise around its performance?
I mean, ultimately with Apple, what investors look at is always, you know, as with any company, the forward projection. And there had been fear that heading into the next quarter, things might be a little bit ropey. Their top-line products is, of course, the iPhone. The iPhone accounts for two-thirds of their revenue, and they tend to update that every 2 years. Now, this year, they are going to come up with a 10th-year anniversary version, which is supposed to be hugely advanced on the previous iteration, and there were some problems in the supply chain which suggest that it's going to be a little bit late. So it wouldn't, therefore, contribute substantially to next quarter's earnings. When I say next quarter, I mean the quarter we're in right now, which ends at the end of September. And the numbers which they released earlier this week showed that perhaps things aren't going to be as bad as people had expected, and inevitably then investors got very excited.
Walk us through the numbers, just how big the Apple fortune is now, the Apple cash hoard, the kind of projections that they're making here, how much Apple's raking in all the time.
So Apple has now a cash and cash equivalents hoard of upwards of $260 billion, and 94% of that is offshore. And that's also kind of a big consideration when you look at the stock performance, because people are expecting that the administration is able to bring in some tax reforms, which make it easier to bring that offshore cash back to the U.S. And in whose pockets is that money likely to land? Well, investors. But Apple is able to do a sort of 20% profit, net profit margin on its earnings, which is a huge figure and almost unparalleled in any other company of this size, with revenue of this size, I should say. That, of course, creates problems, in some ways a rod for their own back. You know, how do they continue with that kind of growth and profitability? And that's what's created some of the doubts in the past 18 months or so.
People look at their value now overall compared to other companies currently and in history. What's Apple look like?
Well, Apple is valued at it's about $850 billion at the moment, which is clearly a staggering number. But by other measures, it isn't valued that optimistically. Apple's valued, differs over the past few months, but between 12 and 16 times earnings. Now, if you compare that to Amazon, Amazon's valued at sort of 180 times earnings. And that's because people are perhaps are a lot more optimistic about the way that Amazon's going to develop in the years to come compared to Apple. So there are some investors who even say that Apple is a value stock because they see a lot more growth potential than perhaps other parts of the market recognize.
That 94% of that cash hoard that's offshore, why are they keeping it abroad? Oh, that $260 billion.
It comes down to tax. You know, if you repatriate money from offshore, at the moment you've got to pay a 35% tax rate. Apple does not want to do that. And with debt so incredibly cheap at the moment, they're able to finance all of their needs inside the U.S. with debt. They've got, I think it's close to $90 billion in debt at the moment. I might have to check those numbers, but it's a huge number. And, of course, they don't need to do anything to repatriate that money with that debt so readily available. Now, there has been a certain amount of controversy, of course, about having all that money offshore. There was people might have followed the tax bill, which Ireland has been forced to impose on Apple by the European Union because they feel that Apple is not paying the right amount of tax anywhere. Apple disputes that. Apple says, you know, the moment they bring that money back to the U.S., they will be taxed on it. And therefore, you know, they should be taxed in the place where they're based.
They're forecasting $49 billion to $52 billion revenue for the current quarter. That's a lot of money. How much of that is iPhone-based? And what about the next iPhone model? What's anticipated?
So the iPhone kind of represents or generates between 60 and 65% of their revenue typically. Now, in the summer period, the months through to June, it's typically a little bit more fallow. The iPhone does about 54%, and that's because customers tend to wait for the next model. They're keeping their wallet in their pocket, mm-hmm. waiting for the next blockbuster. Now, the Christmas quarter and the last few weeks of September, which is when the iPhone is typically released, that's when it really starts to go ballistic and stratospheric in terms of the sales. The next iPhone, we've reported this, you know, it's quite hard to dig into Apple and their supply chain and find what's coming, but all of our sourcing says there are going to be three iPhones. Two of them are going to be updates to the current versions, the 7 and the 7 Plus. They will call this potentially the 7S and the 7S Plus, and will be similar form factors, some improvements perhaps in camera ability and memory and battery life. But the big one is what people are tentatively calling the iPhone 8. That's the 10th anniversary version of the iPhone. It's going to have a different kind of screen technology, which is more energy efficient and requires no backlight, and so there's more clever stuff they can do inside the phone because they've created a bit more space. Also, it's going to have a 3D sensor on the front. What that means is you'll be able to lift your phone up, it'll recognize you and unlock automatically. You won't need to push your thumb on the fingerprint scanner because there will be no fingerprint scanner. And the 3D sensor, unlike Samsung, which also has done some facial recognition stuff, the Samsung thing, it just photographs your face, essentially. The 3D sensor will measure the depth of your face. How big is your nose? How big are your eye sockets? That sort of stuff. And be able to then tell for certain that it's you and not just a photo of you.
Price tag?
It's going to be above $1,000. Some people are speculating even as much as $1,200. Now, that is a lot of money, clearly. But it isn't also as big a jump from the current pricing as people might suspect. The highest range, highest specification iPhone at the moment is about $950. So that's a 7 Plus with all the memory options, battery life you can want. That, so it's only sort of a hop, skip, and a jump then to a phone priced above $1,000.
We read that Apple has cut a deal with Beijing, agreed with Beijing to cut privacy elements of its technology in China for Chinese consumers. Do they pay any penalty for that in terms of the markets?
I don't think so, no. I mean, if anything, the market's probably more likely to reward them. You know, because Apple's treading a very fine path in China. They do not want to annoy the regulators there. But Tim Cook was very keen on the call to make the point that there are still a lot of VPN apps. These are apps which let you perhaps evade the Chinese regulators, available on the Chinese App Store. And that's why they're treading the balance between keeping consumers happy but also not annoying the Chinese regulators.
Apple on the big up this week and helping propel the Dow Jones average above 22,000. Alex Webb covers it all for Bloomberg News and joined us today from San Francisco. Alex, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Check it out, and you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.